Hello, this is Chris English with At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a window to our world, both in and around our city of Brighton Hove and further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. In this programme, we'll be hearing from Andy Crosby about the work of Age UK Brighton and Hove. Gavin Willis from the Hove-based Search 7 will be explaining the charitable ethos of his organisation and bringing us news of some events from which they aim to raise some £17,000 for various local charities. David Lyley will be here to tell us all about Brighton Health Watch, and I'll be talking to Tracy Edwards about the progress and launch of her yacht Maiden that we heard about in a programme earlier this year. All to come in this edition of At Home This Morning. But first up, we welcome Andy Crosby from Age UK, which incidentally used to be called Age Concern. And to get us underway, Andy first explains what his job involves.
It means more or less that I take a responsibility for the day-to-day running of a number of the different services. We have quite a variety of services across Age UK, Brighton and Hove. My particular focus is around information and advice, along with our benefits support that we provide through the Martlets Hospice and also our advocacy service.
A lot of people say Age UK, well, I'm not old. I don't need to be told how to dress myself and things. Where does Age UK fit into everyday life?
That's a very good point. I mean, when I first came to work here, and I've been with the organisation about 2 years now, the first thing I realised when I was coming for the job is actually I fit in their age range. And that, I guess, freaked me out a little bit initially, because many people don't realise that we actually support people from 50 years and above. And I say we, when we're supporting those people, in addition to supporting with them with whatever issues they might have, we're also supporting the carers and children of those people as well, because we have a number of families that live much further away that can't necessarily be on hand to support on a day-to-day basis. So they'll come to us for support as well. So our age, although our primary focus is working with 50s and above, our age range is extended for that reason as well.
Now, of course, we live in an ageing population, don't we?
Absolutely. That's one of,
yeah. The NHS is suffering from that at the moment. So is the situation going to get worse?
Well, certainly, obviously, we're on the increase in population numbers across the city and across the country. Inevitably, as you age, you can be more susceptible to health issues and particular issues that you come across in society. Things like isolation can and poverty can actually encourage more of those things like health issues to increase. So one of our key focuses is to try and support people to prevent them getting into that situation, or if they find themselves in that situation, we support them by helping them to access particular services that will hopefully improve their life and make their life much more a pleasurable situation, a much more happy and life that they can cope with better.
It's identifying people that are in need. Some people who live in sheltered accommodation, for example, they're better off in that way.
Yeah.
What about the person that's living on their own, or a couple living on their own, who never get out, never see anybody else? How can they be helped?
This is a real focus for ourselves. So we as an organisation have been based up at Seven Dials for a very large number of years, and but gone are the days of sitting there waiting for people to turn up at your door. There, many people do, and that's wonderful, and we encourage that. However, we as an organisation have to and are developing and getting better at getting out into the community and getting our message across. We utilise a variety of different settings. We do use sheltered housing or senior housing, as it is in Brighton and Hove, as some of our bases. But, for example, we run a monthly session at the Brookmead Senior Housing Project in Albion Street. But that's not aimed at those people. It is aimed at the people that are living there, but it's also aimed at, there's approximately 16 blocks of flats directly around that. And so myself, in an effort to promote these services, go out and talk to the people like the residents and tenants associations. We go out and talk. We work very closely with other community groups to get that message across to those people who won't necessarily know about us or maybe initially feel that they need our support. So, I mean, that's another key aspect, is that people have a tendency to get by and make do, and they adapt their life to suit the situation they find themselves in. That's wonderful, but sometimes you need that extra bit of help, and so we just want to make sure that we're there and available for them.
One of the things that's prompted this interview is a new publication that you've produced in conjunction with Brighton University, As Time Goes By.
Absolutely.
And what's that designed to do?
It's been recently published this year. This is actually a second edition of this book. It was initially put together in 2012 based on a resilience project that was going on, which was bringing together, spearheaded by Age UK, or Age Concern as we were back then, but becoming Age UK Brighton and Hove, alongside the University of Brighton, and with a team of older researchers and interviewers. So we had a group of, I think it was around about 8 older people that would actually go out and hold interviews with older people in the community. The idea behind it was to actually get looking at a variety of different subjects that affect us all, regardless of what age you are, things from finance to housing to health to well-being, and look at some of those challenges that people might meet, look at ways in which they could actually handle those, and start helping them to think about avenues that they could get support to do so. Having read the book myself, it's full of ideas and suggestions, but some wonderful little quotes that have come from all those interviews that have happened as well, that really allow you to think more about certain ideas. Yeah.
So. And how can people get hold of that booklet?
Well, the booklet, it's a free booklet, I should point out. We have a large supply based at our office at Age UK. We're quite happy to, if someone wants to pop in, they can collect them free of charge. If someone wants to contact us, we can see if we can get copies to them directly from there as well.
Basically, the contact details for that. So we'll come back to that in a minute,
yeah.
Sort of email address and
yeah.
A website and
yeah.
Telephone number, that
Absolutely.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Age UK has been going a long time,
yeah,
and is a national organisation. So how do you, as Age UK Brighton and Hove, fit into the national scheme?
When you might be sitting at home and watch one of the adverts come on Age UK, Age UK National and Age UK Brighton and Hove are different organisations on a frontline basis. The national organisation focuses on national issues but also supports all the various Age UKs across the country, and I think there's in excess of 130 Age UKs in England alone. Brighton Hove work very much alongside Age UK National, but we have a very significant and relevant focus to the needs of the people of our community across the city. So our services, which are primarily funded by Brighton and Hove City Council and the local CCG, and they will be really targeting key issues that affect our community. We work very much in conjunction with the national organisation, and the guidance that we use, the processes, the support, we follow very much the same patterns, and our working arrangements are mirrored. So the work that we do is, for us, focused very much on our individual people within our community.
If somebody's listening to this and they've either know of somebody or they themselves are in need of advice or help, be it just filling in a form, is that something they can go to you to?
Absolutely. And, yeah, I'd very much encourage them. We'd very much encourage them to do that. We'll give some details at the end of the programme. Yes, we, within our service, if we on a day-to-day basis support people with a variety of different issues, whether you're looking to get support to complete a form for housing or housing issues, whether you've got benefits issues, whether you've just got effectively just letters that you're struggling to deal with the content of. We run things like, we have free legal clinics that are supported by pro bono solicitors that run out of our organisation, so we can support with that. And in addition to those sort of things, we can help with any sort of money matters, accommodation issues, any sort of consumer issues. If you're looking for a plumber, we can help you find one of those. If you're looking to socialise within a particular group, we can help you and tie you into other people like that.
Andy, what's new in Age UK?
Right, one of the new services that we're running now is through our information advice service, which has been primarily based up at our Seven Dials Centre. From the last couple of months, we've actually been running new monthly community-based drop-in sessions. We've been running for some time at Patching Lodge along Eastern Road. We've now started a new one at the Brookmead Senior Housing Centre in Albion Street. The plan is that we actually increase these so that we'll have in the not too distant future monthly drop-in sessions across all different aspects of different areas of the city. And in addition to that, they'll be accessible to anyone to access to drop in on. But we'll also be running a variety of different one-off info and advice sessions in different forums. People like with the Women's Institute. I'm hoping to contact a different men's group, different lunch clubs, all sorts of environments where people meet generally, where they're meeting already, and so you don't have to make an extra effort to come and get these services. We're going to try and make them a lot more accessible to people.
Okay, Andy, the time for the contact details.
Okay. Well, first and foremost, our phone number is 01273 720603. Our email address is info@ageuk, that's all one word, -bh.org.uk. And our website is www.ageuk-bh.org.uk.
Andy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We hope this is going to be a regular quarterly occasion to talk to somebody from Age UK.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Now, perhaps you're like me in finding the whole world of the World Wide Web is something of a mystery, and in particular, how it is that your favourite website is always at the top of the list when you start typing into your favourite search engine. To try and find out, I spoke to Gavin Willis, who runs digital marketing agency in Hove Search 7. And I began by asking him, why is that so important and how can it help struggling charities?
It's really important because every brand needs to be thinking about their online exposure. So what we do is try and formulate the right strategies for them to give them the right exposure online and to engage with the right target audience.
So it's not just a question of typing into something, Google or one of the other search engines. You've got to work at it.
Yeah, you do. I mean, there's so much you can get done in kind of a setup phase initially, optimising the website, doing a technical audit, maybe taking live a paid search campaign. But it's the ongoing optimisation. It's building the relevancy, the trust, the authority through creating great content, keeping your site fresh and relevant, doing some really good online PR. And then supporting that with some conversion rate optimization to improve how the site converts, and also paid media in terms of how you can use paid media platforms to engage with the right audiences.
I mean, it sounds far beyond my capabilities of understanding. You say it's important. What happens if you don't take advantage of a company like yours?
I guess the risk there is that there's more and more people every year now spending time online. So online marketing and online in general is just getting more and more popular. So the risk there is that there's more companies doing it, there's more companies investing in their SEO and their paid media activity. And if you're not doing it, you can be left behind. So more people are getting traffic and your traffic to their websites. So you need to be in that mix. You need to be kind of competing with these other brands to just make sure that you are in front of your target audience.
We're here, actually, not to talk necessarily about Search 7, but to talk about a charitable event you've got coming up.
Yes, exactly. So we're called Search 7 because we give 7% of our profits back to charity every year, and that's through donations and also through fundraising events. This year is our seventh year, so we're actually turning seven in November 2018. And to celebrate, we've actually called the campaign, it's called Share 7, and this year we're trying to raise £17,000 in support of seven different charities in celebration of us turning seven. We've already done one event, which was at the Amex Stadium, which we had a football match, and we raised £8,500. So we're halfway there in our target. And the next event is a golf day at Mid-Sussex Golf Club on August the 30th. I want to say a big thank you to Tate's Garage in Port Slade, who are our event sponsor.
So looking ahead to that, you talked about charities. So what are the charities?
We've got a few local charities. So Rocking Horse Charity have been our flagship charity every year. So we've got the Rocking Horse, which is Trevorman Baby Unit in particular, the Sussex Beacon, the Clock Tower Sanctuary, Rise, Group B Strep Support, Alzheimer's Society, and we also sponsor a school in Nakoringo, which is in Uganda. So we've been kind of supporting them for the past 3 years now. So those are our seven chosen charities, which everyone in the company has chosen one each.
Right, I was going to say, how do you get to that? Is it unusual in this day and age for people, companies, of actually saying we're going to give a percentage of our turnover or profit?
It is slightly unusual because I think the stat is 9 out of 10 companies will fail within their first 2 years. So to have that kind of high risk element in terms of giving a percentage of profits to charity straight away, it is high risk because you want to try and protect your money. You want to make sure you're then reinvesting it the right way. But for me personally, it's just something that I really wanted to do. And if anything, I've seen this be a catalyst to us being a success every year. So it's worked really well for us. It's all to do, like, it comes from the heart. It's making sure we're making a really big difference. But it also gives you exposure. It gets you engaging with the community. You're getting to meet people. So it helps promote the brand as well. So I would recommend this highly to anyone thinking about this, about their CSR and what they should be doing, to just make sure that they're thinking about the local community and just, yeah, this is something that everyone should be thinking about.
How do you choose the charities? You say each member of your staff has chosen a charity. Where did that inspiration come from?
The inspiration for me was my godson Ted, and we called the very first event Ted's Trophy, and every year we kind of compete, whether it be golf or football or even a quiz, that we all compete for the S7 Ted's Trophy. And he was in the Trevorman Baby Unit when he was born. He was in there for, I think it was around 10 days, and he was very touch and go, and they pulled him through, and he's great now. And I was in there when I was young as well. So for me, it's very personal, and that's the reason behind the Ted's Trophy and the 7%. Everyone else have the same again. Everyone's got a personal connection to their own charity. So everyone's chosen their own charity this year. We've obviously got the Rocking Horse and the Nicaringo as our ongoing charities. So we've got the other five, which we've all kind of chosen. The other one for me was the Sussex Beacon, which is where my uncle was for a bit of respite before he sadly passed away the other year. And it's just a very personal connection for everyone. So everyone's really behind it. Everyone, all the team members have their own relationship with every charity representative. And it's great for the team. I mean, everyone's really excited about all the events that we're doing, and it gets us out of the office, and we're having fun. We're engaging with charities, community, partners, clients. It's just a great thing to do.
And how important is that fun aspect to a working relationship?
It's really important. I mean, you need to be fun and motivated at work to actually be productive. It's not all about getting your head down and working hard. You need to be in the right frame of mind. And what we try and do here is create this culture of giving and being charitable and having fun. And it in terms of the results, it really pays off. So, yeah, I mean, we've just moved office. We've got a table tennis / table in the boardroom, and we go down the beach for drinks, and we try and get out and do things. We went to the cricket last week. So we're always trying to make sure that the staff's highly engaged, really motivated, and the charity aspect is another kind of really key part of that.
And the charity aspect, and you were talking about this golf day, if listeners can't or don't play golf, how can they support you?
We do have some spaces available for teams. So teams of four is £300. And on the day, you get two courses, a meal afterwards. You get entry into the individual prizes, the team prizes, nearest pin, longest drive. We've also got some hole-in-one prizes, which is 10,000 cash on the eighth hole, and also all other par threes. Tate's Garage are bringing down some cars, which people can win for a birdie on one of the par threes. So there's some fantastic prizes on the day. So it's on August the 30th. You can contact us at events@search7.co.uk, or you can call us on 01273 329 122. If people can't make it but they'd like to support, you can go on our website. We are taking donations through a Just Giving page. And we're also after some companies to sponsor holes. So we've got, I think, six remaining. It's only £100, and you get to put your banner there and sponsor, and every sponsor gets put into a draw to win a prize at the end.
Sounds excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, in the recent hot weather, many of us have been somewhat drained by the constant heat, which has made sleeping difficult. And while not directly connected to the weather, our health is, of course, of major concern, particularly as we get older. And it's just that which is the business of the Brighton and Hove Health Watch. And so when Chief Executive David Lyley came into the Grey Matter studio recently, I first asked him what exactly Brighton Hove Health Watch was all about.
Well, Health Watch was established about 5 years ago to be the official voice for patients and the public in terms of health and social care. So the NHS, but also social care services that are provided or funded by the local council. And in that role, our job is to make sure that whenever services are being designed, provided, purchased, commissioned, that the patient's voice is heard, that the public's voice is heard, and that that influences the way in which services are delivered to people. Basically, so that people get a say-so in the health and care services that they're going to be enjoying.
We've heard a lot recently about how full the Royal Sussex County Hospital is, and when we're recording this, it's just before the Pride weekend, and imploring people basically not to turn up. So is the health service locally in crisis?
I don't think it is in crisis. I think it probably was. I took up my job about 2 years ago in 2016, and that summer of 2016 was an extraordinarily bad summer for the NHS and for social care in the city, but most particularly the NHS. So Healthwatch provided some evidence to the CQC that was part of the reasoning behind the Royal Sussex County Hospital and Brighton and Sussex University's Hospital Trust, which is the trust that runs the Royal Sussex, going into special measures. Our evidence wasn't the only reason, but it was part of it. At the same time, we saw almost the complete collapse of the patient transport system. Not the emergency ambulance service, it was fine, but the patient transport service, the ambulances and taxis that take people backwards and forwards for outpatient appointments. That almost completely collapsed when it was taken over by a private sector organisation called Co-Performa. And again, a lot of lobbying from Health Watch was part of that eventually getting resolved, and Co-Performa being shown the door and given the order, the right royal order of the boot. At the same time that summer, we saw our CCG, which is the Clinical Commissioning Group, the bit of the NHS that purchases all the health services. It went into what's called legal direction, which is a form of special measures imposed by NHS England when they think a CCG is failing. And on top of all that, the Ambulance Trust also went into special measures. So I think back then, we really were in a big mess. Now, there are problems, but there are some green shoots of recovery. Undoubtedly, some things have got better since then. But I wouldn't say that we're completely out of the woods. And we all know that some parts of our health services, like, for instance, GP practices, are under pressure.
You mentioned GP practices. I live in Bullingdean, and our doctor's surgery for the past 40 years has been Meadow Parade in Notting Dean. Now, we've been told that that's closing, which means we've got to go to Salt Dean, which is fine if you've got a car, but not so good if you've got to rely on public transport. Is that something Health Watch looks into? And if so, what can you do about it? Or is it just pure economics and lack of doctors?
Well, it's certainly something that Health Watch has taken a great interest in. Just earlier this year, in February, we produced the largest ever service review of GP surgeries ever done in the city. And that's available on our website. If you folks just put Health Watch Brighton and Hove into Google, they'll find our website. And there's a section called Reports, and under there, you'll see one of the reports is about GP surgeries. And actually, there's one general report, but there's an individual report on every GP practice in the city. So you'll be able to look up your own GP practice and see the kind of Health Watch scores on the doors, if you like. You know, what did we think about it from the patient's perspective? And all the GPs have really welcomed the work that we did, and they've asked us if we'll come back and do it again every 2 years. So, yes, we're definitely on the case when it comes to that. We made something like 160 recommendations for improving the services that GPs provide. And I'm happy to say that since February, something like 60 or 70 of those have already been enacted. So it's not just that we're not talking into deaf ears. That's a pretty good conversion rate in terms of recommendations. But getting back to the point about GP practices in the city, the fact is that we are going to go on seeing some practices closed. Now, why is that? There's a number of different reasons. It's a kind of perfect storm, if you like. First of all, the days of the single-handed GP practice are fading and dying. And as GPs get to a certain age, the mid-50s, early 60s, and retire, those that are in single-handed or dual-handed practices tend to get subsumed into larger practices. And there's probably pretty good reasons for that. I mean, there are things that you lose with that. You lose maybe the local feel. You lose the kind of just-down-the-road aspect of it. But with more GPs, more doctors, more nurses, other professions allied to medicine in one building, that's going to be better staffed. There's going to be more people learning from one another. There's going to be more multidisciplinary team working. So what that means is hopefully people won't have to answer the same questions over and over and over again when they see different people, because all the information will be there in the one place, and the doctors, nurses and others will be able to have discussions about patients and deliver a more holistic service. So that's the good side of it. The not so great side of it is that we're finding it increasingly difficult, the NHS is finding it increasingly difficult to recruit GPs. The nature of the GP's job has changed radically. I was talking to some GPs the other day, and they were saying the difference between working in, say, rural West Sussex and working in central Brighton is chalk and cheese. We know through our own research that most GPs in Brighton will be seeing a third or more people, or having a third or more people on their lists than the average for the UK. And that's creating a very pressurised system. And it means that people are finding it really, really difficult to get appointments with their GPs. The nature of the GP job has changed. There's something like about 130 GPs in Brighton. And I understand that only one or two of them are actually full-time. Most of the other GPs are part-time. They don't want to work full-time. They want to have more of a mixed portfolio of work. And probably they would find it very difficult, very pressurised, to be working full-time. So it's a whole mixture of things, but what it amounts up to is that it is a system deeply under pressure. I don't think anyone would deny that.
Looking back to Health Watch itself, you're the chief executive. How many in your team?
Well, we're a fairly small team. If you were to think of it in budgetary terms, the NHS spends about £450 million a year in Brighton. the social services, the council social services spend about 60 million, and our annual budget is £200,000. So we've got a couple of full-time staff, we've got two or three part-timers, but we've got a great body of about 30 or 40 volunteers. And that's the real engine room for the work that we do. We're very much a volunteer-led, volunteer-orientated organisation. So the working team are there to, you know, make sure the doors are open and we're active, and to guide things like the programme of projects that we run, the service reviews that we run, provide some central organisation, and also to attend some of the strategic committees and decision-making forums where we go and represent people. But actually, the real work is done by that massive group of great volunteers. And we're always on the lookout for volunteers, so folks have got a bit of time on their hands. Again, you know, go on the internet and look up our website and get in touch with us, either by email or phone.
And presumably you don't need medically trained volunteers.
No, we've got many people that are volunteers for us who have specialist skills, which is great. We've got at least one barrister, we've got a dentist, we've got retired GPs, we've certainly got retired nurses, retired social workers. You'll understand what I'm saying when I use the word retired, that means that quite a lot of folks are sort of not spring chickens, not in their 20s and 30s, but we do have some of those as well. We've got lots of people who are experts by experience, so they've actually had conditions, perhaps long-term and serious, persistent health conditions, and having gone through that, they feel as if they want to give a little bit back, and that's wonderful as well. But what's really exciting is that last year we started up Young Health Watch. So it's not just the old crumblies. We've got some young people involved as well. So we're in partnership with the YMCA Right Here project. And we've got a team of young people who they do things like holding listening labs, where they go meet young people where they congregate, find out from them what's important for young people around health and social care. And just give you two examples of the kinds of projects they do. Some months ago, towards the end of last year, they produced a report for us on the experiences of young people when they use A&E at the Royal Sussex County Hospital. So what's it like for a young person going to A&E? Perhaps if they're emotionally upset or in distress or in need in some way. And right now, they're reviewing school counselling services. And they're visiting four different schools across the city and talking to the young people and children there about their experiences of emotional, personal, pastoral support, counselling in the school situation. And I understand they're so popular, they're being mobbed everywhere they go in the school playground. So that's great news.
Finally then, David, we talked earlier about the state of the NHS, and literally, we can see building work going on the new Royal Sussex County Hospital. Do you think that all of the combination, all the extra money and the extra staff we're promised and everything else, is going to enable the NHS to fulfil the dream of Anarion Bevin all those years ago?
I think the NHS has already fulfilled the dream of Anarion Bevin. I think it's more about a new vision for the future. Much more about a kind of a healthier population. The reality that, you know, it used to be that people would retire at 65. By 70, they were a bit cranked out. If you were still alive at 75, well, you were doing well. But now it's not at all unusual for people to live into their 90s. And many live very well, but many live with a whole accumulation of long-term conditions. And that's a new challenge for the NHS. And, of course, in partnership, social care. The money side of things is fairly grim. It's wonderful that BSUH and the Royal Sussex County Hospital are now out of financial special measures. That just happened a few weeks ago, and we really, really congratulate them on that. However, it doesn't mean all their financial problems have gone away. They've still got about £60 million worth of historic debt. It's just they're now living within their means, and the debt's not going up, it's coming down. But the NHS, both in Brighton and Hove and across Surrey and Sussex, has got a really serious in-year financial problem. And here in Brighton and Hove, our part of resolving that will be to make something like £14 million worth of savings in year. Now, that's going to represent something like 3.5% of the total budget. And that's not coming off without considerable pain, because they haven't started saving the money yet. And we're in August. The financial year started in March. So we don't even have a year. We've got less than a year to take that much of the budget away. And it gives me cold shivers when I think about what the implications will be. We do have the new Secretary of State's, or the Prime Minister's, magic money for the NHS, but that's not going to help. That's going to kick in next year, and we're not sure exactly how, where, when it's going to be delivered, what it's going to be spent on. So this year, a tough financial year for the NHS in Brighton and Hove.
But it will survive.
Oh, it'll survive. It'll survive and it'll thrive. And let's not forget that every single day we have hundreds and hundreds of people that work for your benefit and my benefit in the NHS and in social care. And, you know, there is a reason why people love the NHS, and that's because the NHS loves them.
David, thank you very much. Now it's time to catch up with a story that we brought you back in the damp, dark days of spring, namely one amazing woman's plans to restore the sailing yacht that took her and her all-woman crew around the world back in 1990. The boat is called Maiden, and her then-skipper was Tracy Edwards, who found her abandoned in the Seychelles a couple of years ago. Tracy vowed to restore her back to her former glory. Well, she's just about ready to set sail again, and Tracy joins us now. Hi, Tracy. How's the refit coming along?
Well, it's been a long battle, I have to say. We didn't expect Maiden to be in quite such a dreadful state as she was when we got her back in April last year. But we've had her now in the shed for just under a year. And we have done a lot of work on the hull, and we've had to replace some of the plates and a lot more than I thought we were going to have to do. The refit's probably taken about 3 months longer than we thought and cost a bit more than we thought, but then most refits do. But she went back in the water on Monday.
Right. And the mast, I gather, is back in and the paint job is done.
Yeah, you're right. The mast is in, the boom is on, the brand new sails are sitting on the dock waiting to go onto the boat. All the decking work is done, and but there's the linking up of the running rigging and everything else that's happening there. Below, there's a little bit more work to do. We have to commission the engine and link up all the electronics, all the navigational equipment. So we hope that by next Monday, she will be completely ready to go sailing.
Right, and amazing project, really, to get this effectively almost derelict yacht back into round-the-world condition.
Yes, it's been a struggle. But, you know, we've had so many amazing people helping out on this project. Of course, we've got Her Royal Highness Princess Haya Bint Al Hussein, who's funding the project under her Anything Is Possible banner. And she's been, I mean, without her, we couldn't have done this. Just as without her father, we couldn't have done it the first time. So she's been fantastic. And we've had 35 people working on the yacht at one point. We've got our amazing new crew, Amelia, Bell, Tilly, and Mary, and they've been coordinating the refit from on the boat, which has been incredibly complex and very, very complicated procedure, as well as all the hard work. And then we've got all the shore crew. You know, we're a team of 16 people now. We've grown from 1 to 16 in a year, which is pretty crazy. But, you know, it really has been a journey, and so many people have helped us get to this point. You know, I'm very lucky to have the people around me that I do.
And would you have started if you knew it was going to be as difficult as this?
Yes.
Why is Maiden so special to you?
We always really thought of Maiden as the 13th crew member, and, you know, we've rescued her once before. We rescued her in 1988 when we found her rotting in Cape Town. She'd been around the world twice at that point, once in the 81-82 Whitbread Round the World race with Pierre Fellman. And then she also went round in 1985-86 with Bertie Reed, who took her round single-handed. You know, so she was getting on then. She wasn't in quite such a bad state as she was when we found her this time. So bringing her back and, you know, sort of getting her sorted out then. We really formed a bond with her, and she was always part of our team, if you like. We learned as we went along, really. And, you know, she was part of that learning process, and you know, sort of winning two legs and coming second overall was obviously very special. So when I heard that she was again in trouble, in distress, in the Seychelles, when did I hear? At the beginning of 2014, I just knew that this, you know, she's a British icon, you know, she's a historical part of our maritime history, our story, if you like. And so I knew I had to rescue her, I knew I had to bring her back and make sure that she was restored for posterity.
Absolutely. And this, as we're talking, it's actually Cows Week, and there was a bit of celebration for you and the whole crew.
Yes, we went over to Cows Week on Tuesday to introduce the new crew to everyone there, and we also announced we are going to have guest skippers on the way around. So we have a permanent crew, and then we have legendary guest skippers. So we announced Wendy Tuck, who's just become the first woman to win a round the world race, winning the Clipper. And we also announced Dee Kafari, who of course has been round the world six times, which is twice as much as me, and was the first woman to sail single-handed both ways around the world. So we announced those two. And then in the evening, I was very honoured and just very humbled to receive the Lendy Ladies Trophy. And I couldn't be there, so my new crew went to pick it up for me, which was brilliant.
And you're nearly there, so you've talked about other people. Are you going to sail on Maiden again?
I might dip in and out as she goes round, but I made a decision very early on that I couldn't recreate what we had on Maiden, what I experienced on Maiden, and I wouldn't want to. And I don't want the new crew to feel that I'm sort of there looking over their shoulders. You know, we've got great skippers, a great crew, and this is about Maiden and them, and of course about raising money for girls' education. So I'm more shore crew now.
And when does the voyage start?
Her lap of honour, as we're calling it, the world tour starts on the 22nd of September when we leave from the Southampton Boat Show, and our first stop is Jordan, because even though we've got such strong links with Jordan, the boat's never been there, so it'll be her first time there.
And will you be there to see her off?
I will. Yes, we'll all be there to see her off. We're going to have a big fleet following her down Southampton Water as she goes out towards the Needles. And then we'll fly to Jordan, and we'll meet the girls and Maiden as they arrive there.
And will there be a certain regret that you're not actually on board?
Do you know, funnily enough, I don't think so. I am quite philosophical about these things, and I've learnt really from experience that if you try and recreate something you did, it often turns out to be not as you imagined, not as you wanted it to be. So my time with Maiden has been fantastic and extraordinary. But this is her new chapter, and I'm just thankful to be part of it.
Tracy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Chris.
That was Tracy Edwards OBE talking about her very special sailing yacht, Maiden. And that's just about it from me, Chris English, and this edition of At Home This Morning. There's just time to repeat those all-important contact details. For information on Age UK, go to www.ageuk.org/Brighton&Hove or telephone 01273 720 603. To get more information on those Search 7 events, simply telephone 01273 329 122 or email gavin@search7.co.uk. For details of Brighton Hove Health Watch, the contact is David Liley, whose email address is dlily, that's D, no gap, L-I-L-E-Y, at healthwatchbrightonandhove.co.uk, or telephone 01273 234 041. And finally, for more information on the Maiden Factor and Tracy Edwards' adventures, simply go to www.themaidenfactor.org. So just time then for me, Chris English, to thank you for listening to this edition of At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production, and to again thank my executive producer, Richard Davis, for all the technical operation matters.